Rolls and donuts were excellent. Thank you.
My meeting in Madison is now complete.
And I believe we are to number 19, Roy Lake Resort Transfer Sale.
Morning, Mr. Chair, Commissioners, Secretary Hepler. We have Roy Lake Resort as an action item. We put it on the agenda that way, thinking that if we got a viable offer or submittal for the resort, the concession, that we would need to take action to approve that. As you know, last month we approved a prospectus that would have allowed for an agreement to purchase the possessory interest at Roy Lake as part of that prospectus offering, and we did not receive any viable offers. We didn't really see any interest in the concession. So that puts us back to square one. What you did take action on, along with the prospectus last month, was a purchase agreement to drop the price at Roy Lake to $449,000. We are going to pursue that with the owner. We feel like that is the place to be. That's our next step, is to purchase his possessory interest for that $449,000 along with personal property, and the department would then take over that area and manage it. And so that's the option we'll be pursuing. We'll be working on the purchase agreement with the concessionaire at the agreed upon price of $449,000, and we'll likely be bringing that back for you like next month, and hopefully have a signed agreement, and we'll ask for your blessing on it at that time. So,
thank you. Any questions or comments? Well, thanks. Okay. So we are 220, which is Echo Sun Prairie Partnership at Good Earth.
I think we wanted to make that adjustment, Mr. Chair, and move Madison Area Park update up. I've got right. Individual that needs to get on the road, so I'd ask Willie and John Baim maybe to come forward and give that park update, please.
Good morning, Chair, Commission, Secretary Hepler. Thanks for having us. Thanks for the hospitality of Madison, right? Thanks for coming. Thanks for listening to us. I've got with me here John Baim, our district supervisor. I'm here out of Madison, his office at Lake Herman. He's also responsible for a lot of the lakeside use areas and boat ramp access sites in the area, as well as Walker's Point over on Lake Madison itself. John and crew have a lot of efforts put back into the community here, which they're only about a mile and a half from town, so a good close connection there, and they're very active in that. John will have a presentation here to go over a few of those things for you.
All right. So we'll just kind of flip to the first slide here. Hopefully you guys can see that pretty well, but just a quick little park, little overview of Lake Herman State Park and Walker's Point. We do have about 110 campsites here at Lake Herman Walkers, about 4 miles of hiking trails, boat ramps, day use areas. One thing I want to add is Lake Herman State Park is on the State Register of Historic Places. One main reason for that is it has a lot of Native American history and culture there. We have habitation there as far back as 12,000 BC. And so that significant historical resource that we need to protect there. Got it to put it on the state register. Loose Cabin is also on the National Register of Historic Places as well, too. So a little overview, we've got about 130,000 people in visitation, about 9,000 camping nights, and about $320,000 in revenue. That we are tracking a little low this year, but partially to the two floods that occurred this year have pretty much majorly impacted, not majorly, but has impacted that revenue source and camping use for that time. But hopefully, pending no flooding next year, we should be back up and going, so to full use. One thing I do want to show here, and it might be hard to see, but this is a programming, this is a website the department put together to track all the programming that we have in the state park system. For my part, we do a lot of programming at Lake Herman and Walker's Point, and so I utilize this resource. It's a very handy resource for us. It can kind of show, I'll kind of read through it here shortly, but we do about 84 programs, generating about 4,500 people that we interact with on those programs. 75% of them are youth, so right around 3,500, and 1,000 are adult. So that's kind of just kind of an overview of what we do for programming here. If you look on the three bars that you can see a little bit over there, the large green one is culture resource interpretation and cultural historic interpretation. We probably spend a lot more time on cultural historic interpretation Lake Herman as opposed to other state parks. Part of our cultural resource and importance we have there. It's important for us to interpret those resources and also on our strategic plan to make sure that we're educating the general public on our historical importance at Lake Herman State Park, one of our strategic plans to accomplish. So it's a great tool. I really enjoy utilizing and checking it. It gives me an understanding of where we're at and what we're doing with our programming at Lake Herman State Park. Just a little quick overview. The other two, we do outdoor education is the red and environmental education. So we're teaching people to enjoy the outdoors, and we're teaching people about cultural and natural resources at Lake Herman State Park are our primary goals there. So one thing kind of to break into more detail, and Willie was talking about, we do a lot of community cooperative programming here at Lake Herman State Park. Just to kind of show the list of the people that we interact with on a regular basis, the Madison Community Center, the three school districts, Madison, Ramona, and Rutland. We work with a lot of youth groups, Boy Scouts of America, Teen Advisory Board, Casting for Kids, Fish and Wildlife. I work a lot with the Game Fish and Parks Wildlife Division with Cody Simmons doing programs, Isaac Walton, DSU, the list really goes on. And so we have really good connection with those organizations. We're able to do things that we wouldn't normally be able to do with a three full-time staff. So we're able to do a lot of programs. And just to go on to the next slide, one thing we spend a lot of time on, working with the local school districts. We do a lot of field trips, a lot of activities. One thing to kind of go into detail is we do a May Madness event where we get all 300 middle schoolers of the Madison school district, and we do 12 different activities simultaneously for that day to get the kids outdoors, canoeing, archery, orienteering, disking, BB guns, hiking, yard games, birding, and a lot more activities. So it gives them the experiences that they wouldn't normally get at home. And it's really a great effort that we do in the community. The Madison School District really is one that kind of cornered me on this program. They bring 12 volunteers to help facilitate this activity. Cody Simmons and his group of COs, he usually can pull about 6 to 7 conservation officers to help with the BB guns and the canoeing and the archery. And so I really appreciate his help and his coordination in doing that. We get Fish and Wildlife conservation officers to come with this program, and we get the step outside trailer. So Jason Nelson down at the outdoor campus, he usually provides 2 or 3 staff, brings the trailer out. So we've got bow and arrows, we've got BB guns, we've got canoes, we've got all these resources. It's really like it's just a really great event to get the youth involved and get the middle schoolers involved. Hopefully they'll gain experience and knowledge that they can utilize for the rest of their lives. So we do a second grade habitat hike with the Fish and Wildlife Service where we go out, you can see in the lower picture there, we go out and collect milkweed, which then is, the milkweed seed is then collected and then utilized for planting for habitat. We teach the youth about importance of habitat for wildlife. We teach them about the wildlife themselves. And so it's a real neat little field trip for them, and they really enjoy that as well. We do PE class for the year, disking, snowshoeing, loose cabin tours. I do a multiple outreach programs with them as well. So I'm usually pretty active with the local school districts. And the cooperative with the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Cody Simmons outdoor Cody Simmons and the conservation officers and the outdoor campus really gives me that opportunity to do programs like that. Just a couple other programs I want to bring up. The Madison Community Center, we're working with them. One issue I have is we have 20 staff in the summertime, seasonal staff, working office, working things like that. So we have people at the office. In the wintertime, we're down to 3 full-time staff. So we don't have the resources to have somebody in the office all the time to check out snowshoes and things like that. So I'm actually working with the Madison Community Center, and they're going to actually check out snowshoes, which we've acquired through the Department of Health. And so they will, their office hours are, you know, 7 days a week, 8 to 4 p.m. So now people can come to the Madison Community Center, check out snowshoes, utilize those at no cost, return them back, and learn, you know, do some winter recreation that sometimes we don't always have in the park system. And then in return of that, I have the ability to work at the CUNY Center and do, we're going to start doing snowshoe basic programs where they'll advertise that at the community center, they'll sign up participants, and I'll take anybody, adults, kids, and do a snowshoe basics training. And then the second time, we'll take them out of the state park and kind of give them a little more of a challenge of doing some snowshoe basics. So it's kind of neat to have that collaboration with the community center. I hope that continues to increase. We also do Project Wild, which community center designed and works with, we work with Cody Simmons and get 10 to 12 kids outdoors fishing, boating, learning basics of to become a fisherman or a fisherwoman or hunter. So summer programs, one more thing I will add, we do a kids fishing tournament with every free entrance weekends. That'd be the weekend before Memorial Day. We get about 50 kids out there. We get, we're with Cody Simmons, Casting for Kids, which is a local nonprofit that generates funds to help facilitate this program, get kids outdoor fishing. Isaac Walton, and with that group, we're able to get those 50 kids out, have a good day, fishing tournament, and have a good time. See a little picture? He was really proud of that walleye he caught that day out at Lake Herman State Park. So. Next, one positive with all this interaction, and it's a lot of work for me to work with all these groups, but one thing that I've noticed that comes back return is I get a lot of volunteering. I get a lot of people interested in Lake Herman State Park. I got a lot of people wanting to help out at Lake Herman State Park. So we get a lot of volunteering. Boy Scouts of America, I get a lot of Eagle Scout projects that come in. We've had a canoe launch done. We've had a game shed built by them. Dakota State University, they do a community cleanup day to where we get 35 students, and they actually get, the community quite utilizes them. They get hundreds of students to come out throughout the community, but we get about 30 of them, and they get to clean up a trail, do some kind of project at the state park. And lastly, at Loose Pioneer Day, we get about 20-some volunteers with the Kiwanis, the Madison Library, and local groups just from the, to me, the support and excitement that we have for the Madison community about Lake Herman State Park. So a couple things that's coming up this year. We do have the Loose Pioneer Day, which is the 13th of June. We do a lot of living history where we get people dressed up in pioneer clothes, learn how to make rope, Dutch oven cooking, just all the varieties. Teach kids how to make butter, which is by kind of funny, but you know, think of all that manual labor that used to be done, and now they enjoy doing it as a recreation activity, and it's pretty cool. So we are getting two new camping cabins at Lake Herman State Park, which will be a nice addition to the to recreation there. We are also doing a Herman Pond aeration project. So you see the picture of the Herman Pond. It's about a 40-acre lake within Lake Herman State Park. We've had some issues with low oxygen levels in there. I've been working with Todd St. Sauver and Kip Rounds, the fisheries crew in Sioux Falls, and we've come to a determination that we need to get some aeration in there. And we have the, and we've purchased the aeration systems actually through Todd's budget, and hopefully we'll be getting those installed this spring. And from that, we'll get some good oxygen levels there, and maybe it'll produce a good urban fishery for the Lake Madison area here. So my big return is I want to see, I'd love to see a lot of fish in there. I'd love to see doing more kids fishing programs with that fishery. So it may take a little time to get that built up, but that's the hopefully end result of that program. So lastly, we do have a flood update. I did have two floods come through Lake Herman State Park. Nothing extreme damages like dams or bridges that occurred in some of the other state parks. We really just have to do, we've been doing a lot of shoreline stabilization, flood waters, pumping, removing the debris, and then just repairs to some of our facilities and utilities. So this spring, really to get us up and running, we've got to get some grass seed planted. We have our electrical project that needs to get upgraded so we can replace all of our electrical pedestals that were already planned anyway. So that way we'll have new electrical pedestals for the spring camping or the summer camping season. We do need to be cognizant that there could potentially be some flooding in the spring and be prepared for that. And then do some tree evaluation, make sure we have some, make sure that our trees are safe before the camping season. But barring any major flooding, I don't see the Lake Herman State Park should have any real complications in opening up for the summer year. So.
Willie Kellogg, not here. So one thing you see on here that's probably not really associated with flooding a whole lot in the state park is pumping. And one of the interesting things with Lake Herman is its lower campground, it has no outlet, has no drainage. And so like the picture you see up there with the playground, that whole entire area, it can accumulate a foot or more water there that actually has to be drainaged and pumped out of there or it will not leave. And so that's one of the extra things that John and his staff do have to deal with every time this water comes up. You know, once the grounds are saturated, every time it rains, the campground actually has to physically be pumped out in order to become operational. So just something different and significant there with Lake Herman.
Yeah, the old pumping crew comes out, and in about a week we get it pumped out and opened up for use. So any questions?
Could you tell them about the loose cabin?
Yeah, and so the picture back there is the Herman Loose Cabin. It was developed in 1871. It's actually the first structure built in Lake County, and it's still here standing today. So in 2004, we had a Deadwood grant, and where we were able to restore it to a pretty original standing. It's in pretty good shape now. The timbers are original, and so those timbers are over 100 years old. And so we do a lot of Herman Luce interpretation. Herman Luce was one of the first, you know, people here, white settlers in Lake County, and he actually set up at Lake Herman State Park. And so a lot of the history interpretation does relate around that cabin. It's a really neat structure. I'm glad we have it in there. We can interpret it and show basically what people would have lived in back in the 1800s. So.
Question, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Phillips. So we have to pump the campground out periodically through the
really during heavy water events. So in 2012 we had another, not necessarily major flood, but we did have a good rain where we had to come in and pump some of those lower areas out. As there's about 20 some campsites that impact those 70. We have 75 campsites there, and out of that we probably about 20 that impact it. And yeah, there is some elevation issues. Again, this campground was built in 1960, and that additional loop was put in 1975. And so there might not have been a lot of thought and concept
of that was my second question.
How to develop drainage back then. So
are there areas we could move those to? Or could it be relocated?
I don't know. I mean, one issue with that is we have a lot of archaeological sensitivity. And so one thing that we do at Lake Herman State Park, we actually have a cultural resource management plan that we work with local tribes and Dennis William, our cultural resource manager. Anytime we do project, like we talked about the cabin installation, that took probably 2 to 3 years to implement. We have to make sure that we're not getting on any significant sites, that we're not negatively impacting that. So moving that is really hard at Lake Herman because through a lot of research we've done, actually being on the state register, they dug like 400 test holes, archaeologists, and out of those 400 test holes, they found 6 that were negative. Meaning, out of the 6 sites, out of the 400 site test holes, all of them had some kind of archaeological, whether it's pottery, whether it's arrowheads, whether it's anything like that. So with the extreme Native American history there, culture, I don't know if we'd be able to ever move that at Lake Herman.
Thank you.
Commissioner Olson. So just Phillips there. So that's, you know, it's one of those things where it's Lake Herman's a really cool spot, right? It's got great trees right there in the water, and it pretty much has always been there. And so it's been a cool place for humans to occupy for tens of thousands of years. And so that just compounds in there to a lot of the extra efforts for every type of movement, new facility, any improvements to the infrastructure that exists within the park.
Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question, but an observation. Back in 2018, I think it was about May, when we had that effort to get younger people engaged, and we had the fourth graders where we went around the state and invited fourth graders to hear from Game Fish and Parks, not so much commissioners, but staff, and try to get those folks reintroduced, give them a free park pass for them and their family. And I was a little nervous. I volunteered to do that because I really do want to see more young people get involved. So I lined up the appointments for the private and the public schools here to with the fourth graders, and reached out to John. And I didn't have to worry about the show because he stole it. He was just on fire. Those kids instantly connect to him. He's a natural at it. He really is the bomb when it comes to interacting with those young kids. And what he does, when you hear him talk about all the stuff he does with the youth, it doesn't go unnoticed. It really, we have a hidden gem out at Lake Herman, and John does a great job. So I just wanted to give you an attaboy for that. You've done a great job. And the thing you're doing now with the snowshoes and getting the things to the community center, I was going to ask you what we could do to help promote that, because I think that that's something else in the wintertime. What a beautiful place to go snowshoeing. So thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Nope. Thank you guys very much. Now, should we do Good Earth? Right.
One thing I vowed I'd never do is take John Boehm on in a beard growing contest. Commission Chairman Jessen and Commissioners and Secretary Hepler, thank you for giving us the time. We got kind of a unique presentation here today. With me, I have Dr. Carter Johnson, who's a retired emeritus professor from SDSU, and I'll let him speak a little bit later here and give you the background on this. But at Good Earth, we've, as you know, we've accumulated quite a bit of property, and some of that, most of that, we've converted into native prairie. We've got one piece in the middle, and I'm just going to quick orientate you here. So if I can do this steadily, this is Sioux Falls, this is Harrisburg, and this is the Good Earth area right here. So this area up above here is kind of the primary Good Earth property. The Big Sioux River kind of flows down through there. And then down here we have the Spring Creek Golf Course, which will be taking over the management of that in 5 years. And then we have Lake Alvin and a couple of GPAs down here, 9 Mile GPA and Lake Alvin GPA. So Game Fish and Parks owns quite a bit of property in this area here. But in the middle of this area kind of outlined, is a 106-acre ag field that, there it is outlined again, that we have been farming for well over two decades. We've looked at that, and what are we going to do with that? It's the connector piece between the park, the primary park, the core park, and the golf course area. And so we need that, and it's critical, and it's got some archaeological significance to it as well. So, you know, our plan was to restore that into prairie at some point. We can only take on so much every year. So anyway, along came Dr. Carter Johnson with an idea, and I'm going to let him share that here a little bit. And I think this will form a great partnership, and we'll kind of talk about some of the advantages of this at the end of the presentation here. I did say 106 acres. There is 106 acres that is ag field. Then there's some additional acreage in there outside of the ag fields that we would be leasing to his group. So it's a total of 144.
My turn?
Your turn, sir.
Okay. Can I move that? Yep. Background is this. I grew up in Sioux Falls. I was born in Sioux Falls and grew up in Sioux Falls. My family ran the largest sporting goods and hardware store business in the state at the time. So I was very early on indoctrinated, shall we say, about the importance of conservation and wildlife and fisheries and all those things. So that's my background. But I decided, after I realized how much work it was, and my dad said, well, do you want to do this or not? I said, well, I think I'll hold off on that. and I went and became an academic instead. The hours were a little bit too long in hardware store business, if some of you know about that. So Johnson Hardware may be in your background, if you remember that store back in the day. Then otherwise, I got my doctorate at North Dakota State. I worked at Virginia Tech for 12 years as a professor, 8 years in Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and then I came to South Dakota State as a department head of horticulture, forestry, landscape, and parks back in 1989. And finally, I said 50 years is enough, so I decided to retire. The other organization that I'm associated with is EcoSun Prairie Farms, which I started in 2007. Let's see, In 2007, which is a South Dakota nonprofit corporation, and it's designated as a 501c3 public charity. The mission statement is up here. It may be a little hard for you to see over there. I will read it just for emphasis. And this sort of covers the goal of the organization, how it intends to do its work, and then the link to Good Earth State Park at the end. So it's our goal is to reverse historic losses of native prairie by integrating working fields of grassland into contemporary agricultural, borrowing from the findings of EcoSun's 7-year prairie farm experiment. There's a lot of stuff in there. The use of perennial, low-input native grassland crops, you don't see that very often, to develop profitable and ecologically sustainable farming systems also leads to recovery of diminished life-sustaining ecosystem services such as fish and wildlife, soil health, climate, and waterway protection and recreation. This regenerative approach will be applied through an active program of education, research, demonstration, marketing, and outreach at EcoSun's Prairie Ecosystem Center at Good Earth State Park, where the historic native prairie ecosystem supported a vibrant indigenous human society for centuries. So that's a lot of information there, but the basic idea here is that we're not getting more grassland on our landscape, even though there are many programs that do that to get more. But the net change of our grassland, especially tall grass prairie, is still continuing to decline. And we had a really bad loss of that back in 2008, 9, and 10. So the question is, how else might we get more grassland back on the landscape? And then our approach is, after a 7-year study that I'll show you in a minute, there is profit in prairie. There's all these other things we know it's good at and help us out with all the ecosystem services, but there's actually ways of making a pretty good living from prairie if you market things correctly and if you are looking at it not just from the services it provides, but also from the potential for profit, and that those can go hand in hand together. So that experiment was done up near south of Brookings, about 25 miles on a conventional farm, and we converted that farm from cropland to grassland and restored about 20 or 30 wetlands that had been drained. Started in 2008, completed in 2015. Maybe some of you visited us during field days, but we did have quite a bit of activity at that time. Again, the goal was to study the economic viability of a working grassland farm established on cropland soils. This is one example of the 400 acres of grassland that we converted back to various mixtures. We wanted to have a variety of types of grassland. So some of it is high diversity, like this one, which included both cool season and warm season plants and grasses, as well as other crops that were used, other fields that were used for seed crops and so on. So the 400 acres was restored back along with the wetlands there in order to then, once these are mature crops, is to market them and see what kind of income we can make from them. Another source of income was grazing and cattle. These cattle were stocker cattle brought from the Mortenson Ranch in western South Dakota, 75 usually each year. and the products from those, included grass-fed beef, which was sold in Sioux Falls at a couple different places, retail markets, and mostly through EcoSwim with direct contact to customers. And that was a very successful income stream. So one of the income streams could be grass-fed beef. This is several thousand pounds of switchgrass seed, which was one of the other income streams of this farm. And that's another source of income. There are times when prices are very favorable. It's like anything else, though. Sometimes it's higher and sometimes it's lower, but this was a very important income stream for this farm. And hay, of course, forage for cattle, but also hay that's sold on the hay market was another source of income from that farm. So in 2014, which is a reasonably typical year in the later years when everything's mature, this gives you an idea of how much material was produced. So for hay, 400 tons of hay was sold, 5,000 pounds of beef, both retail and wholesale, was sold, and 8,000 pounds of seed was collected and sold to retail seed dealers like Milburn's and Brookings. So this is what the project did that we call the Prairie Farm Project. The Good Earth Project is an extension of that. We will have a demonstration area in that 100 acres that will show people how to plant these grasses and how to manage them and how to market from them. There'll be a trail complex running through this grassland for people to see the real tall grass, for how tall it really gets when it's planted on reasonably good soils. And we found that from the Prairie Farm. You know, we're not used to seeing these tall grasses on good soils because most of that's been converted to agriculture. But when you plant back and you look at, we were getting a blue stem at 7 to 8 feet tall and cordgrass at 10 feet tall. So the tall grass prairie is not just a name, it's a reality in that kind of system. So moving on to Good Earth here, our project involves a series of stages. We're not going to start with everything immediately. We're going to work in some stages over the first 5 years. Getting the prairie restored, of course, that's the first thing to do. It takes a year or two to do that, or even more sometimes. And that's where our demonstration will be to the public. And then seed collection. You probably also know as we lose more tall grass prairie and we're down to a small amount that we're losing genetic diversity. When a plot of prairie is plowed up now, all those plants that were producing seed and that germplasm is going to be gone forever from that site. And we think it's time not to wait too long like Iowa did and all the prairie was gone and they only had prairie left in cemeteries, to go out and collect that seed and to then store it, some for long term, some for short term. And then with phase two, stage two, produce from maybe a few ounces or a few pounds of that seed large enough amounts that we can actually contribute this to the restoration industry and we can get more diversity back instead of that diversity continuing to shrink over time. And the education outreach, obviously we need to educate people about the value of prairie and all of its values that it has. While the wildlife is pretty clear, I think people know pheasants depend on grassland for their nesting, and deer depend on it for cover and for food and so on and so on. That's pretty well known, although we could probably do more with that. But I think some of the other sources of holding soil and holding soil and getting water to percolate in instead of run off, and carbon storage, and all of these things are really important as well. I don't think the public really knows much about this. If somebody's drinking water in Sioux Falls, they want it to be good water. They may not be hunters, they may not be fishermen like many of us are, but they want clean water, and grassland and clean water go hand in hand. And then the on-site seed production, where we'll use the site to produce larger amounts of some of these seeds, particularly those that are relatively rare. And then eventually project consolidation. We'll start out in several different places in Sioux Falls, but we'll move into one place probably in year four or five to get all of our components together. So in stage three, we'll have our full staff and we'll be operating it at full capacity in year five of the project. And then you had this, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Stole your thunder, maybe.
No, no, not at all. No. So from the parks perspective, but also I think I can speak for EcoSun Prairie here too. You know, we see this as an opportunity to utilize their expertise in on habitat, native plants, and to bring that into the bulk of the park as well. We have a number of acres of native grass stands at Good Earth State Park, and although we've got some great staff that's talented at that, I think Carter's team brings that up a whole notch higher. So annually they will perform a management plan for us on those grasses and give us a prescription as to how to maintain those. Secondly, we're going to use them to convert something we were going to convert at some point, the 106 acres there, crop field, into native prairie. It's, you know, we've looked at that ground many times. What should we do with it? What can we do with it? One of the significant factors we have to contend with there is it's within the blood run historic landmark. It's got some cultural clearance issues that will be associated with it. So we'll be somewhat limited as to what we actually can do on that ground. So this fits really well with that. And then thirdly, I think this is probably one of the more exciting things, not so much for the park, although we're certainly going to take advantage of this, but I think for the department and for the general public, is we're going to have a research partner on site that's going to be demonstrating alternative land use practices. The goal here is not to convert all ag land into native prairie, but to help landowners see maybe some different ways that they can manage some of their marginal lands. Same with the department, where they can actually not only manage them, but maybe make some money off of that and those kind of demonstrations. So you want to add anything to that, Carter?
I think that your last comment is really important, that we all know that the farm system these days is in real trouble, and we feel that we offer something to help in that, and that input costs are extremely high, but a grass system is perennial. You plant it once, and if you manage it right, it goes on for decades. So the input costs are far lower. And on lands that might be somewhat marginal for farmers now, given the fairly low grain prices, the grass is a pretty good alternative. And I think all grassland in that capacity would be profitable rather than losses. Now, it may not be hugely, this is not a get-rich-quick scheme here. It's going to be solid, it's going to be perennial, it's going to be more stable, I think. And this is offering an alternative, and one that we've actually tried out for 7 years. And we marketed all this stuff, and we know it's profitable. In some years, it was more profitable than grain farming would have been on the same land. So it's worth taking a look at. I know it's a David and Goliath issue here. But I think sometimes these little germs get started and take off. And so I would second that for sure.
So just to wrap up here, we're going to enter into a 5-year agreement with EcoSun Prairie to manage this land for us. And I'm not going to get into all the terms of the agreement, but basically they will plant the prairie at their expense. We will still own the land. I think this is a great period of time for us to kind of test out this relationship. At the end of the 5 years, they would, you know, assuming everything's going well, they would like to extend that beyond that. At the same time, the land at the Spring Creek Golf Course will be coming under the management of the Game Fish and Parks at that particular time. And we'll be looking at that property as well. We've talked openly that there's a clubhouse on that property. We've kind of struggled what to do with that clubhouse. That could possibly be an education center for EcoSun Prairie. So lots of things in the works there. We're taking it one step at a time. But, this is kind of a unique venture, unique partnership. So with that, I think we'll take any questions.
Commissioner Beese.
Commissioner Beese here. Just a couple different things.
You mentioned the carbon footprint. Did you do any testing on that when it was crop ground and where it is back up is the native grass prairie? And did you try to market the carbon credits off of that?
Mm-hmm. We did do detailed carbon sampling, and we published a paper in a scientific journal on those results about a year ago as to what was lost during cultivation and what could be gained by replanting. And you may know there's a Sioux Prairie that's not too far from where the prairie farm was, which has not been cultivated. So that's sort of your baseline. So we compared the farm we had that had been cultivated for 100 years with the one that had never been cultivated. And what we found out was that half the carbon has been lost through tillage on upland soils, and about two-thirds of the soil carbon in wetlands has been lost during that period of time. But it's beginning to bounce back, but it's slow. You can't just plant switchgrass and think the next year you're going to be back to where you were. Nobody knows how long it'll take to get back to where it was. It may never get back to where it was. But it is bouncing up, and it's near the surface is where we start seeing the increase. We did not try to market what we had gained, in part because we did not own the farm. We leased the farm, and the lease was going to be only for so long. And so we didn't really own the carbon in that particular farm. But that paper of ours is getting a lot of interest because not many people have done this, especially comparing it, having a baseline to compare it to know what we started with 125 years ago. So, but that's available. If you go to the EcoSun Prairie website, you'll find a seven-year report, a rather lengthy report on everything that we learned and what worked and what didn't work. And then you'll find a series of journal papers that go back, such as the carbon paper, that give you the details about that. And let me tell you, carbon in soils is an extremely complex subject. The Europeans are quite a ways ahead of us on it, and they were our reviewers, some of them, and they're tough. But we got through it and got our paper published, and I think our results are some of the few around that show you what the gains can be. And I think I would say that the article tempers a little bit some of the over-enthusiasm of how fast you can get carbon back.
Yeah. Have you gotten anybody else to take your plan and convert some of their crop ground to this?
During the time we had our field days and so on, we had a lot of farmers that did small trials. Some were already doing it, actually. Some people had been planting like switchgrass for 5 years, getting a crop of hay and pheasants, and then converting that back to cropland with a pretty good gain, they said, in the soil improvement, and then planting the switchgrass somewhere else. So they rotate their crops. And the prairie farm is continuing, it was all grassland, but we realized that if you're going to start into this, it's going to have to be a piece at a time, maybe start with the marginal land and see where that takes you. And then, you know, if crops grow better on good soils, so does grass. And we produce some pretty good amounts of grass, 4, 5, 6 tons of hay per acre. Now, it's not high-quality hay, but the way we blend our hay now with all these other things, the hay itself is still worth quite a bit, the fundamental hay.
So back to the golf course, you might have kind of answered that a little bit, but GFNP ain't going to run no golf course?
Well, we do like to golf, but no.
I like to golf too.
No, that's not our mission. That you know, we're looking at that ground and what could be over there. Obviously, one of the factors or one of the facilities we'd like to put potentially there is a campground. You know, it's a unique opportunity. So we're going to get that in 5 years, but then we have a 10-year period of time where we can only do soft development on that. And that was all part of the covenants and the kind of the demands that came with the purchase of that property. So more to come on that.
Commissioner Whitmire.
Commissioner Whitmire, yeah, thank you. It was a great presentation. On the working lands programs, I haven't discussed this with the department yet, but back home I've talked about our programs, which I think is a great program, but there was some input that I think currently we're looking at August 1 as a cut date, first harvest date for that grass. And there's suggestions that if we could move that to July 15 for the first cut so that the pheasants and ducks could have that nesting. You mentioned, I guess I saw on a slide there, that you had two cuttings on the for your harvest. If you, in that situation, if you could, what would you be your thoughts if you were to delay your first harvest until August 1? I mean, I would suspect that you really wouldn't have a second harvest at that point. But as far as nesting birds, if you've had any thoughts on that.
It's sort of complicated in the sense that it depends on what your composition of grass is. And if you have only warm season grasses, then, of course, what we ended up doing is doing a dormant season harvest. So you wait all the way till September, and it's sold as dormant hay. Now, the protein's a little bit lower, but, of course, you're getting a full stand, too. You're not cutting it early and getting less biomass. So it still comes out pretty well monetarily. The early season would have been cool season grasses that we also had, either in fields by themselves or fields together. The best deal was to do both together. So you do cool season and warm season together, which isn't commonly done, and you have options. So you could harvest in the spring, late spring, early summer of the cool seasons, and then get a harvest later on the warm seasons. Or you could decide to take one or the other, or you could graze part and do the other. So that was the best option, and we didn't worry too much about that July time period because we weren't doing a lot of the cool season harvesting, which you could. But yeah, I think we should certainly adhere to that middle of July time for any hay harvesting for sure, from the pheasant standpoint. But that the best, I don't think I ever would plant again just the warm seasons, which a lot of people do because of the brome problem in the spring. But in these fields, there's hardly any perennial plant seed there. So you have a carte blanche to start with cool season native plants that then repel brome a little bit. But when you just plant warm season, you leave it open for brome because warm seasons are asleep when the brome moves in the spring. And this way you can counter that with that something or somebody's already there, Mr. Brome. So, you know, you better, because we had very little invasion of brome in the 7 years, very, very little. And so that's another route to go. But it is pretty complicated, and but I think the best way to go is to go with from the native standpoint to plant both together. It like nature had it planted. Nature was cool season, warm season, both together. Yeah.
So it's really intriguing to me. And is there a way that, or maybe you've done it, that we could assess all the land that we own or manage, considering that maybe this could be expanded or extended? And how about our habitat efforts and the habitat fund? I mean, is this... seems like there's a lot of opportunity here to look beyond this particular parcel and at least examine whether it fits the rest of the land that we have, or focus on habitat and habitat funds, because we talk in the habitat fund about perhaps adding programs there. This to me seems like it's like almost unlimited opportunity.
Chairman Jensen, I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer that question.
Well, I wondered. Somebody in the room is, I bet.
But I do think maybe that's the intriguing part of the partnership here, is they're going to bring in some real expertise. And, you know, we want to, you know, we purposely not just gave them the 106 acres, but you saw the draws and that in there, too. We want to see what they can do in some of those marginal grounds as well. I like to think of it as a research farm within our park that not only the park can obviously learn from, but the department can learn from, and landowners across the state. That's really the goal here.
Yeah, and
I don't think I can answer your question. Maybe Tom wants to jump in on that or something.
It'd be nice to know what you guys think about it. It just seems like we need to think beyond this particular piece of parcel or piece of ground.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Tom Kirschman, certainly I think there are opportunities here. It's a grand way of putting more grassland habitat on the ground that can have multiple benefits. Obviously, the wildlife perspective there, the soil health, water quality, but also the other opportunities for potential landowner use from livestock and other things as well. So certainly an opportunity in that we need to look at other parcels of ground that we have and see how this may or may not fit into the equation. I don't have a definitive answer where that may or may not be, but it's certainly worth that discussion and looking at it and see how we can maybe incorporate that. Most obviously, it would be a good conversation with the Habitat Fund Board, too, and see if other opportunities where they could become involved with this. And again, more partnerships is going to lead to more opportunities. And sure. So it certainly fits in that overall discussion.
You know, not only GPAs, but maybe other parkland. I mean, gosh, there's a whole laundry list of places we should look and think about. Well, great. That's cool. Thank you.
I want to say one thing that I want to thank Jeff for working with me for how long has it been now? year or two? Yeah. And being able to partner with Game Fish and Parks, which is the premier conservation organization in South Dakota by nowhere close, even though you have lots of good partners that are doing more smaller things, but it's the premier conservation organization, and for us to be this closely attached to them, where we have all the different folks out there that are on the ground doing the work, and I think that's going to help get the project extended. But I really appreciate being able to link up with them and to locate our project at a state park, which is a really super thing. And the Native American background is terrific too. And, you know, we fundraise for our organization. We're not independently wealthy, and so we need to fundraise, of course. And the Native American connection is a really important one here for the fundraising for us, even though we're not directly related to the tribes. But what we're doing is very favorable for the tribes at Good Earth, being able to put that land back to something that a lot like it looked like before, with the big blue stem that was eaten by the bison and which they ate and lived on. And getting that back is, I think, an important thing from that for that point as well. But I'm really happy to be able to link up and sign a contract with the state.
I think we're happy we can do it too, so thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Right, so we go to 21 Buffalo Auction.